Please take your seats. I'd like to call the meeting to order.
See if we can get that.
Take a roll call. And you said that we have a quorum? Perfect. So the first thing I'd like to do is adopt the minutes from the last meeting. I guess we'll hold off on that until the chair shows up. And so I guess we'll start with day two of Food Week. We've got a lot going on today, just like we did last time, so we're going to try to pack it in and be efficient with everybody's time as well. So Jean Poppy looks like she's actually in another committee right now. She is presenting a bill. And so on Tuesday, we heard about food insecurity issues that face many Minnesotans and how the Good Food Access Program is working to increase access to healthy foods across the state. Today, we'll hear from a number of folks who are also making an impact by helping establish food access programs, connect between Minnesota food sources and food shelves, coupling community farms and those in need, and how alternative food delivery systems are providing new markets for farmers and new opportunities for businesses, institutions, and the public access to high-quality fresh food that's locally grown. We had a couple of presenters have a cancellation because of the weather, of course. You know, things aren't exactly ideal out there. And we might need to be flexible on scheduling today, but still have a number of great presenters that are here today. And so we want to make sure we give them some time as well. Thank you all who made it, and would like to share this program with you. We're going to hold our first presenter until Chair Poppy returns. And so I guess next we'll talk about the youth-led ag and food access initiatives. And so Ben Larson, I'd like to call to the stand. Right? Not here? Okay. Well, I guess he's not here. Sorry about that. Mia? Okay. So next I will call Mia Elise to the stand from Northside Fresh Coordinator and Policy Manager for Appetite for Change. Is she here? Weather got her too. Okay. Sorry about that. That's the flexibility part, right? So I guess next we'll call Chris Harms to the table, founder and executive director of Giving Gardens, White Bear Lake. So just as a little bit of a background, Giving Gardens provides complete garden bed meals to adopted homes whose fresh produce will be donated to local food shelves. And I'll let him take the stand and go from there.
Thank you very much for having me this morning to talk a little bit about Giving Gardens. And thank you, Ms. Waslowick, for keeping a local nonprofit in mind. Giving Gardens, I founded back in the spring of 2017 with the idea that people could be put in touch with the need in their area in a very accessible way by volunteering to adopt garden beds for their yards, their faith communities, their places of business. And Giving Gardens would provide, we would eliminate the financial and material barriers by providing all of the resources necessary, including delivering and installing the raised bed garden for free. And what we ask is that a majority, 51% or more, of all of the produce grown from that garden be donated to one of our local food shelves, which includes the White Bear Lake Emergency Food Shelf, the Matamidi Food Shelf, the Hugo Food Shelf, the White Bear Lake Senior Program, and there's many other organizations that benefit from the work that we do. So that's the way that we deploy our resources to get people engaged in the community in volunteering in what they see as something that's really meaningful. Something that I think a lot of people don't have that's not readily accessible to them in this day and age is that in a community that's as beautiful and wonderful and most recently voted Minnesota's best town by Minnesota Magazine, we also have 29% of our students in the White Bear area school district that qualify for free and reduced meals. So to say that they come from food insecure households would be an understatement, and that number is probably closer district-wide to 37-38%. Food insecurity, as you well know, is not just not having enough food, but having the right food. Over 1 in 4 of our local seniors is not going to have the expendable income to fully fund a nutritious diet. These are folks who built our community, and something I'm probably most proud of about Giving Gardens is that we brought over 500 pounds of fresh produce over a period of 8 weeks to our local senior program. So in putting people in connection with not only the information, but with fresh produce, those are our two products, is community awareness and then bringing something to market. Not only do we do something different in the product that we bring, the product we bring to our local food shelves for those in need is fresher than the produce that you can go today to Cub, Target, wherever, and buy yourselves. And that's a real point of pride, to bring the very best that we have in mind, and keeping in mind those who suffer financially or maybe experience other barriers such as limiting disability, age, transportation. We're in the business of creative food sourcing, is what I like to call it, because we are creating something that wasn't already there. We're not steering or redirecting different food to different places or making that system more efficient. And that's something that we're really proud of in the contributions that we make. All in all, to all of the food shelves that we support and the senior program and other organizations, we brought over 3,500 pounds of food in the growing season of 2018. We were fortunate enough to be featured in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Bobby Jensen and Laura Betker from Care 11 came out, and we did a Grow with Care segment. So it's been really fantastic getting a lot of the well-deserved media and attention that really our gardeners create. To give you an idea of how we're growing in size, we started out in the spring of 2017, which would be like our pilot year, with a prayer and hope that people would want to adopt 50 garden beds, and they went really quickly. We now have over 200 4 foot by 8 foot raised bed garden structures that you can see a picture of in the trifold that I passed out. In the White Bear area community, serving, generally speaking, the areas, the communities around the lake, Hugo, Matamidi, North St. Paul, White Bear Lake, White Bear Township, Vadnais Heights, parts of Shoreview. In 2019, we are going to deploy another 100 garden beds to our area to further bolster bringing as much fresh produce to those in need at our local food shelves as we can. And we are going to be embarking on our newly minted 3-year strategic initiative that will bring us to operating as a 4-season growing organization, so that we can continue to bring the bounty of our harvest to our local food shelves on a year-round basis. I think everything else that's worth saying I have in my handout materials, so I'm not going to take up any more time, and I'd like to thank you again for having me here this morning to talk about Giving Gardens.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Harms. Next, we'll call up Joe Nowak from the University of Minnesota. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Tabke had a question, Mr. Harms. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about the seasonality of this. What is your plan for making it full season? You just said that I didn't quite understand. Is it happening soon, or is it in the future, or what? How are you planning on doing that to deliver year-round produce?
We plan to acquire a spot of land in White Bear Lake and then partner with the University of Minnesota Extension Program, who are working with partners all around the state in doing deep winter greenhouses. And the essential concept of deep winter greenhouses is that you dig a hole, put river rock at the base of it, put vents down into the rock, cover it up with dirt, and it keeps the soil warm, and you then pull down the warm air from the top of the greenhouse down into the ducts, which go back into the river rock, which keeps the dirt warm, which keeps you functioning four seasons a year. And then from that point, you can either supplement with light, because spring's going to come at some point here, but it's not going to be today. Supplement with light, and you can have then the wider breadth of vegetables that you want to grow, or if you're solely going to go off of the light that we get from the sunlight in the wintertime, you're going to be limited to greens and other things like that. But we also have volunteers who want to do that concept in the name of Giving Gardens, and we're in a very sensitive manner trying to work through that, because we don't want to deploy something to somebody else's land. The whole reason that I didn't go with a community garden to begin with, tongue-in-cheek, is because in April you have 30 really excited volunteers, and in October you have 3 very disgruntled ones. So, and accessibility is key. With that four-season deep winter greenhouse, we plan on bringing our students through there, not only in the White Bear Area School District, but surrounding areas throughout the cities, to benefit from acquiring and attaining this knowledge and this spark that I'm sure that everybody can remember something from childhood. And hopefully it's that spark that, 20-plus years from now, by 2040, when globally we need 200% more food than we do today, we're inspiring children today to think smarter about how we do that. So that's the goal. Thank you.
Follow up? Okay. Representative Cleburne?
Yeah, I think this is a great thing to give opportunities for people to give back to their community this way. But could you please explain to me how are the goods collected at the end of the year? Do you have a truck and you make the circuit, or do people bring their produce to you, and then who cleans it to get it ready to go to the shelf?
Thank you.
This is, again, one of the aspects that I'm really proud of. I just put out a survey to ask people, hey, if we more broadly collected produce from you, would that help you in either donating more or make it easier for you? Food shelves, who are many times operating not necessarily on a full-time budget, don't have expanded hours where people could drop it off before or after work. Anyways, 80% of our people, our giving gardeners, as I like to call them, said that they would not like a pickup service because they take joy in bringing their stuff into the food shelf. And I know every time I'm able to go in there with my kids and bring the cucumbers or zucchini or whatever it is that we grew, seeing the face of need in my community adjusts the perceptions that just so osmotically or naturally sort of leak in. They clean the produce as well. Are they, being the growers, are responsible to clean the produce? Thank you.
Representative Wazlow.
I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Harms, for coming in and speaking about Giving Gardens today. I was around when Mr. Harms was talking about this concept, and it seemed like an idea that was... this is before White Bear Lake was named the best town in Minnesota. But I grew up in White Bear Lake and kind of knew how the community was in terms of giving back to the community and being really supportive of people who are vulnerable in our community. And so saw the idea and heard about it and was glad to see that it came to fruition and that we have so many raised garden beds. And if I had a yard of my own, I would have one in my yard. But I don't have one of those at this time. So thank you so much for taking time to come here today and share your Giving Gardens with us.
Absolutely.
Anybody else? Any other questions? Okay. Next, we'll call down Joe Nowak and David Conanis. And please state your names, and you're free to speak.
Hi, I'm David Katsonis. I am the manager of the St. Paul Growers Association and also on the board of directors for the Minnesota Farmers Market Association.
I'm Joe Nowak. I'm a PhD student at the University of Minnesota, and I'm here representing Hikaru Peterson and myself. We lead the Farmers Market Metrics Project.
All right. One of the Farmers Market Association's initiatives, as you'll see on the handout, is the Market Bucks and SNAP EBT programs. You can read the statistics there for yourself, but I just really, as far as this program goes, I want you guys to know that it's really a program that works to serve the community of the farmers markets. It's reaching lower income families. Increasing their access to locally grown, more nutritious foods, and the dollars are ending up with our local farmers. It just really seems to me like a program that works quite well. It's been going for roughly 10 years, and it's now reaching just about 100 farmers markets throughout the state. Any market that accepts the SNAP EBT benefits can participate in the Market Bucks program. Another initiative that the Farmers Market Association has been working on is turning farmers markets or creating food hubs at the farmers market. It's been a successful program. It's been running for about 2 years. It's at 11 different markets throughout the state. The markets become an aggregation center for the local growers and then can make sales to institutions that perhaps wouldn't be able to buy the locally grown produce from these individual farmers because it's too much work to go out and make all these connections for the institutions, so they can come here and they can buy more so in bulk with the veggies and get them. And the farmers are also able to participate, the small farmers, in the selling to the institution. So it's increased sales for the participating farmers and connections throughout the state. The farmers markets get a food wholesale handler's license. But it's been a good program. I worked in Rochester for quite a while, and I know the Mayo Clinic had been looking to expand purchases of locally grown foods from small independent farmers. But that's the problem that they were running into, was that they didn't have the time to make all of these connections with all the individual small farmers. So in order for ease and to save money, they had been purchasing from larger distributors. So food hubs allow the small farmer to be able to sell to big institutions. Food hubs in general, especially the brick and mortar ones, and there was a really good one in Mankato that didn't make it. The food hubs in general that are outside of large metropolitan areas are having a hard time making it, with expenses just being too high. And so we have had as many as 14 food hubs. We currently have 5 brick-and-mortar food hubs, which really kind of makes these farmers markets as food hubs a nice alternative, because we don't have the building to support. We don't have the high expenses that these other food hubs have come into. Thanks.
All right, so just want to give you a little bit of quick background here first on the Farmers Market Metrics Project. This is a project that kind of came to the university by way of the market managers themselves. Markets are, in terms of data, behind a lot of other parts of the food system, because they really lack the data and metrics needed to kind of advocate on their own behalf to policymakers and even potential funders. So they came to the university for help on that. How do we find out more about ourselves so that we can kind of tell our story? So myself and Hikaru Peterson have been working on this project since 2016. Does everyone have this handout here? So you can kind of see the map, the second slide there, shows the number of markets that we've worked with. We tried to start small because we really wanted to focus on every market we work with. We wanted to be able to tell the whole picture from every angle. So other studies that have been done in other states have looked at just vendors or looked at just consumers. We're looking at the market manager, we're looking at the vendor, and we're looking at the consumer. So we're trying to tell the whole story. We started at 12 markets in 2016. You can kind of call that our pilot season. We have roughly doubled every year since, 27 in 2017 and 53 last year in 2018. The goal is to reach all 90 to 100 markets that we know of in the metro area this coming season. We've reached last year 937 unique vendors. I think that's more than a lot of people expected existed. Everything we get is kind of the first time we're getting this information. Anyone's known this information because this hasn't really been done before. So before anyone asks the question, I want to point out something quirky in our data. So on the second two slides, the visitor metrics slide and the vendor metrics slide, you can see total sales number on both slides. On the visitor metrics one, it says 45 million in total sales. That's pretty impressive. If you look at the same number on the 2018 vendor metrics, it says 18.4 million for total sales. Now, this may seem like a large difference, and it totally is, but if you think of every vendor underreporting just a little bit, that adds up. If you think of every consumer over, you know, selling how much they spent at the market just a little bit, just a little overestimate, customers tend to do that, vendors tend to do that. It's still incredibly helpful for us to now know that we're looking at a total sales number in the metro farmers markets between 18.4 million and 45 million. Granted, it's a huge range, but we didn't even have that range sitting here 3 years ago. So we're starting to be able to build the picture of what farmers markets are contributing to the local food system, and we just never had that before. The other number that I'll speak to here is the fourth line down on the vendor metrics. 63.1% of vendors whose farmers market business is their only or primary occupation. So this is critical to our farmers and food entrepreneurs in the local food system, and we kind of had a hunch about this, and market managers have been really preaching how important markets are in the food system, and they don't often get the credit, but now we're starting to put some numbers behind that, and that's what's really exciting about this project, I think, is that finally farmers markets are going to be able to have the data that they need to be able to really talk about their impact.
Yeah, I would like to add a couple of things to what Joe was talking about. As a farmer's market manager, I've used this data already. I manage 22 farmer's markets in the St. Paul kind of metro area, and this information has been really helpful to me. We were just in it for the first time this past year, but the questions that they ask the customers about how did you hear about this market, you know, I'm looking at, and I'm using that to make decisions in my marketing. And it's been very helpful. And I also would just like to say, yeah, farmers markets are great incubators for small businesses. My association works with 170 small family farmers. So things, dollars spent on farmers market gets dispersed over a wide scope.
I think a lot of people have really good feelings about markets, but up until this time, we haven't really been able to back those up. And so other parts of the food system have better tracking capabilities. You know, if you're a restaurant or a grocery store, you typically have a better way to kind of talk about your impact. Farmers markets, because of the nature of direct sale, farmer to consumer, have typically not had that before, but it's about time that they kind of get credit for their impact. So that's what we're working on.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
I apologize I missed some of your presentation, but I'm happy that you're here and being able to present to us today. Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Madam. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. On the handout, the Minnesota Farmers Market Report, on the second page, public policy, you're proposing 2019 amendment to the cottage food law. What does that amendment look like? What changes need to be made to the cottage food law?
I'm afraid that I don't have that. I'm sitting in for Kathy Zeman. We are in support of the cottage food law and the pet treat, but we just want to make sure that all the food safety aspects of that are in place.
Representative Hamilton, is that any? Thank you, Mr. Katsanis.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if there's something we need to be brought forth. You know, I know that we have amended that law a couple times over the last few years, and so I'm just curious on what else needs to.
Well, we're still in need of an author for our resolution.
Okay, thank you,
Madam Chair.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple questions for testifiers. I'm just curious, as you talk with your farmers, I know this can often be a very precarious business for growers. If you have a sense of what primary obstacles for farmers are in sustaining success, so that's one question. Another question is a sense from the farmers you work with as to the next steps for growing their business. Are there any themes that emerge as you're having conversations with growers?
As far as the challenges and obstacles that they have, access to land for beginning farmers is huge. You know, a lot of our newer farmers who are getting in it are renting land. It's expensive. It's hard to, you know, it's hard for someone who isn't, like, granted or given land through family to get started. The machinery costs are extremely high. You know, I'm really impressed with some of our immigrant farmers because they're renting land that doesn't have access to water, and so they're having to bring in water for their plants. And then with cottage foods, the cottage foods program, it really gives people a chance to expand what they do. I like to see growers who, in the spring, they're selling plants, in the summer, they're selling produce, and then in the fall and winter, they're selling canned goods or, you know, pickled veggies, where they're really making it last throughout the whole year. And so, you know, having good information about cottage foods in different languages so that we're reaching everybody is really important. Language is still a barrier for a lot of our growers. I would say about 40% of the growers of the St. Paul Growers Association are Hmong, and there are still language barriers with the maybe the first wave of immigrants who are probably in their 50s.
And I would also just offer in answer to both of those questions, primary obstacles and growing businesses, the data and metrics and a real awareness of where they sit within their competition. Mm-hmm. And not even just in a competitive way, but where do they sit in the marketplace in terms of not with just other farmers, but with other food entrepreneurs and other folks who are trying to get into, you know, grocery stores in terms of growing that business. Do you start at a farmer's market? You know, farmer's markets we've really seen be a food incubator, but what if their next goal is to make it to the Whole Foods? But they don't have the data to, you know, figure out how to make another mm-hmm. step there. So helping them get the information they need is an obstacle that we're trying to address as well.
And one thing I'd like to see for Minnesota is continued work to extend the growing season, which is, you know, like the deep winter greenhouses, hoop houses, and then some of the hoop houses are heated with propane, so the propane costs can get pretty high depending on winter. Different incentives to help small growers, grants are really important. I was really happy to see that, you know, the Farmers Market Promotional Program and Local Food Promotional Program grants are still available through USDA. But programs like that are really helpful to reach a lot of people. They have a great impact.
Representative Cleburne.
I have a question about alternative energy for maybe these alternative and growing the season. I know that in Amsterdam, well, I'll just say the Netherlands, they use excess energy that's generated by, let's say, a solar or nuclear power, whatever alternative. So if they've got a business that's generating a lot of heat, so let's say a server farm or something, then it might be able to capture that heat and reroute it to a greenhouse for the growing seasons that are colder. Is there any plan at the university or in your association for that, like, capturing of excess heat from other entities?
Not that I'm aware of right now. I do know that, like, in Cleveland, they have greenhouses where they can use compost to keep the greenhouses warm. Mm-hmm. So they have compost kind of in the corners. But it's just a little too cold here for that to work. And I do know that there was a big solar solar incentive, and a lot of the farmers have taken advantage of it on personal levels to bring solar panels onto their barns and such.
Can I ask one more follow-up?
Yes.
The other question is about using technology to capture data. Are there programs available to farmers who are just beginning to help them with their technology so that they can either have broadband or they can have access to iPads and things like that to capture point-of-sale data?
I was involved in a project a couple of years ago that started to look at some of that, but I think sometimes the technology is fantastic, but it's sometimes just one more thing for farmers to have to worry about.
True.
And so that's why, like a service like we're providing where we try to do that work for them, so it's one less thing that a market manager has to worry about, or because they're already overworked, or one less thing that a farmer has to worry about. We come to them at convenient times to try to get the data from them, mm-hmm. so that they can really focus on their interactions with their customers.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. And Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at this sheet regarding the farmers markets as food hubs. I'm curious to know what is the decision-making process for selecting these 11 cities and how that came to be. And considering that Hmong farmers have a pretty significant presence in the markets, just curious why the metro cities are included in this too.
Well,
Mr. Katsanis.
I would say that the 11 who were chosen were 11 that wanted to participate, and so it was you opted in. Personally, the work falls onto the market manager, and as a market manager, I don't feel like I have the capacity to take on the role. So that's why St. Paul isn't. I'm spread too thin, and I just can't do it. And so that's why I think you don't see them in the metro area. Although Richfield is on the list, it's a smaller market.
Thank you. I think we're going to need to move on because we have some other presenters here, unless somebody has some final questions. But maybe we can did you have another follow-up, Representative Vang? You're okay.
Yeah, I think, Hmong farmers do face, as we all know, multiple barriers. I mean, language is a big one, and I think, a lot of this pilot is addressing a lot of the issues that small farmers go through, like having that alternative markets, trying to make it more profitable outside of the farmers market, and this is something Hmong farmers have been going through for quite a while, and I think this, if they know about this pilot program, they will be very interested in being part of it.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the presentation this morning.
Thank you very
much. Yeah, appreciate
thank
that.
You very much.
Yes. And we'll bring down Obala next. Obala. And, I feel like today is one of those experiences where Representative Rod Hamilton would say, we want it all.
Right?
Right.
Right.
Is that not, this is a good example of local markets can be important for some farmers, as global markets are important to other farmers. So as we're talking about the access and the opportunities, that's what we're learning about today. So appreciate that. And with us next is a person that I know because he's actually from my college. He's a student at Riverland Community College, but he's the vice president at Lead Min, which is the student organization for the two-year college students. So welcome to the committee. please introduce yourself and provide us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of committee, my name is Obala Obala, and I'm a student at Riverland Community College. I will be graduating in this May with a human service degree and my associate. And then I will go to for my bachelor to pursue social work. I am the vice president of LEADAMEN. LEADAMEN is a statewide student association that represents nearly 120,000 community and technical college students from every corner of Minnesota. Our mission is to ensure quality, affordable, accessible higher education while providing students with presentation and leadership development. At LEADAMEN, we empower 2 years college students to become strong leaders, engage community members, and successful professionals. I am here today to talk to you about food insecurity and the work I have done on my campus and the work that we are doing at LEADAMEN to help address this issue. It is something our students are facing every day on our colleges. This is a very touchy subject that not every student is comfortable talking about because of the stigma around it. I moved to the United States 4 years ago from Africa, and before I moved here, I was living in a refugee camp in Kenya. Someone may question, how does food insecurity relate to life in a refugee camp? Imagine living life where you only have one meal per day or 2 days. Well, that is my lifestyle before I moved here 5 years ago. In a refugee camp, the food is distributed once or twice a month, based on the size of your family. So for us as a family of four, we only got something like 20 pounds of rice, 40 pounds of corn, and 4 liters of oil. My family had to make sure it would take us through the month. That is how we lived for 10 years in the refugee camp. When I moved to America in 2013, I thought I left the issue of food insecurity behind. But soon I found out I was wrong. When I started college, I thought I wouldn't need to worry about the high tuition and the textbook costs because I was told financial aid would cover everything. That wasn't true because after my FAFSA got approved, I didn't qualify for any state grant because I had not lived in Minnesota for 1 year. Because of this, I had to find a second job to afford college costs and pay for an apartment. Working two jobs and going to school full time, I still did not have enough money to pay for my food. At the start of one semester, I remember withdrawing all my money from my saving account to pay for my textbook. While waiting in line, I talk about how much I had saved, $1,080. My friend whispered to me, "You are rich, bro." I tell him I will be broke in 2 minutes. After paying for my books, the only change I had left was $1.50. From there, I went to cafeteria to get some french fry and some chicken nugget with the change that I was left. To my surprise, it cost $2.50. I only had $1.50 in my pocket. I looked up and cried inside. Before I left the line, one of the students asked me if we could combine my $1.50 and his dollar to share the french fry. I told him, sure. We got the fry and walked away from making jokes to each other about the struggle of food insecurity that we are facing. It is painful, right? He said. Before he left, he asked me if I could do something about food insecurity issue that we are facing at Riverland since I was the Senate President. More students continue expressing interest in doing something about food insecurity, and we as a Senate decide to raise awareness about the issue and start a pantry on our campus. I took the lead and started lobbying for it on my campus and around the community. With the help of our advisor, Keith Chase, 6 months later, we had a food pantry, which has ended up being a great resource to our students. That food pantry right now has been serving more than 400 students every month. And when you come to Riverland, the line is way far every day. When my term ended at Riverland as a Senate president, I decided to run for Leaderman Vice President to bring food insecurity awareness to the state level. I feel like something more needs to be done to help students who are working so hard to get higher education, but their dream has been blocked due to not having their basic need met. If students are hungry, they can't focus on school or do something or do homework that they need to do. According to last year's Hope Lab national survey, over more than 43,000 college students, 42% report being food insecure. Another survey found that 55% of food insecure students could not purchase textbook. 53% missed their courses. 25% dropped course due to the impact of hunger. This is why Leaderman began working to help address food insecurity on campuses. When we began raising food awareness around this issue last fall, we were stunned by how many students have come forward with their own stories and experience with food insecurity. This year, Leaderman has worked with our Student Senate to develop an action plan for each Senate to address food insecurity on their own campus. This plan are helping our Senate to do things like creating food pantry, creating hunger task force, raise awareness on food insecurity, and provide information to students on available resources. We also have multiple campuses where we directly involve in helping make the case to campus administration or foundation about the need for a campus food pantry. We have also collected over 300 student quotes and stories on their experience with food insecurity. Finally, Leaderman is looking to legislature for assistance in addressing this issue. In coming weeks, we will be introducing legislation that will create hunger-free campus, designation for campuses that meet certain criteria, and provide grant funding with campuses match for them to achieve the designation. We believe that creating this designation will help encourage our college to step in addressing the challenge of food insecurity on our campuses. Food insecurity is a major problem that affects students every single day and is something that I have experienced personally. I hope that my story will help empower students who are struggling with hunger to ask for help, and the work that we do will help reduce food insecurity for our students, because our students should be hungry for food, but hungry to learn. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Abala. We have a question. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Abala. You're doing an awesome job. One of the things that I do when I don't have my legislator hat on is I manage a humanitarian food aid organization called Kids Against Hunger. And we currently provide meals to three Minnesota State locations and, believe it or not, several K-12 locations that have food shelves. And we'd be very happy to provide you with food. We do things like apple cinnamon oatmeal with soy in it so that it has some protein and it has vitamins and minerals in it. And we do macaroni and cheese that has soy and vitamins and minerals in it so that it's healthy macaroni and cheese. And we developed these once we found out about this problem in the Minnesota State system up in my neck of the woods, which is Central Lakes College and Minnesota State Wadena. But we'd be happy to work with you and talk to you about the seven meals that we provide and get it shipped down to your school and to your food shelf. It is a big problem, much bigger problem than we ever thought. When I founded our organization, our primary mission was to send food abroad, you know, because we all have heard the horrible stories of how things are out in the world. But shortly after opening the organization 5 years ago, we started hearing about all the issues right here at home. and at our colleges and at our K-12 schools. And we currently provide food to about 35 food shelves in north central Minnesota, and the need just keeps getting bigger and bigger. So we'd be very happy to work with you. You know, if you're around after the meeting, let's share some information, and maybe I can give you a hand.
Sure. Thank you.
Keep up the great job.
I've sent a post, and very much appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah.
You helps to educate all of us, and to provide that connection is wonderful. So thank you. Appreciate that. I don't know, are there any other questions or comments for Mr. Obala? Nice job. Very well done. And safe travels when you do go back. So I think we have another question. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Obala. I just wanted to say that my heart was aching as you were telling your story and thinking about your journey, all that you experienced in a refugee camp and then all of you even experiencing the last few years, and that students, hardworking students like you, shouldn't be going hungry. And I deeply appreciate your work, and I think it's up to us to be working together to find systemic solutions to what you're going through and what others are going through too. So thank you for sharing your story. It had an impact on me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vang.
Yeah, I just have a quick comment. You know, food insecurity is very, very real, of course. I think once something that not often is recognized is that it's important that you know, my family, we've been also food insecure as well. But when we receive food from the food pantry, it's like cheese and crackers, and those are food we don't eat, right? So I think it's really important that we have that cultural specific component to it. And I've worked for an organization called CAPI, and their food shelf is culturally specific Southeast Asian. And it serves the majority of Southeast Asian community in the area. And so when we talk about food insecurity and talk about, you know, it's not just donating food, but also donating the right kinds of food as well.
Thank you. Thank you for that comment.
Thank you.
All right. Appreciate the opportunity to have you here today. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for giving me this privilege to be here.
Absolutely. Next, we're going to bring up Maya Felici. And I believe she's here. Yes. Thank you. And I know that Ben Larson is listed here, but he's not able to be here due to the weather, but he does have information in our packet. So, and you'll be able to take that and read that when you can. But welcome to the committee.
Hi.
So if you would introduce yourself and be able to provide your testimony.
Yes. My name is Mia Ulysses, and I'm the policy manager for Appetite for Change. There are some brochures that are being passed around just so that you have a little bit of a visualization. I'm a picture person. I like to see what I'm talking about. And we came before this committee a number of years ago, continually up until 2017, to advocate for urban agriculture. And if any of you have seen our Grow Food video that made quite a splash across the nation, just preaching the benefits of urban agriculture and youth involvement in really creating this movement. I'm here to talk a little bit about Appetite for Change and the work that both Appetite for Change and Northside Fresh Coalition have done to promote urban agriculture and really strengthen the local food economy in North Minneapolis. We are an organization that was started by three women around 2011 and formally organized as a nonprofit in 2012. And they are women from the Northside community that really were looking at the Northside from the perspective of somebody who has lived on the Northside and seeing the changes within the quality of food, grocery stores closing, the tornado that passed through about 7 or 8 years ago. And we're really looking to find solutions that were suited for the community and by the community. And they started out of a church basement and convening space for community members to come and cook a meal together and just talk about the food that they ate, what changes they would like to see on the north side, what it would mean to have a just and local food economy that survives and thrives on its own. And it's one of our staple programs that we have called Community Cooks Today, and we have a variety of different facets with that program. We have one for new and expectant mothers where they're coming and They don't have to get on their feet. They have a meal cooked for them. They have child care available that is used to be able to provide a space for them to really just decompress and talk about their bodies and their health. We have one for youth where they can just listen to the music they like to listen to, dance around in the kitchen, talk about what's on their heart around food, and one for the general public. And this has been the primary way that we've really gotten into the community and looked at what we needed to build out in North Minneapolis to be able to make sure that our community members were having nourishing food available to them at an affordable price. And since then, we have grown astronomically. We run the West Broadway Farmers Market, which has been in existence for about 6 years. We have an urban agriculture program. It is a youth-led program that has over 120 youth that are on our payroll in 2018. And we go out to our urban plots in North Minneapolis. We teach them how to grow food. We teach them the basics of harvesting. They learn customer service skills, working the farmers markets. And then they receive a number of other training opportunities within the classroom at our office. And it's a really amazing way for us to be able to talk about how our community has used food from a farming perspective and our ancestral roots to be able to nourish our bodies and really bring that back. And the food that they produce goes into the cafe that we run. If any of you have ever heard of Breaking Bread Cafe, we won the best shrimp and grits in 2017. I guarantee you, you'll love them if you come by. But we've really worked to create a very inclusive but comprehensive approach to how we solve the issues of food insecurity in North Minneapolis. And just a little bit of a statistic, about 12% of Minnesotans across the state are considered food insecure. And so whether you're a college student, a Northsider, someone in Ely, Minnesota, food insecurity touches the entire state, so not just North Minneapolis. And we have over 50,000 residents in North Minneapolis. It's a pretty large neighborhood of the Minneapolis area, and urban agriculture has been one of our primary tools to be able to really get out into our community and talk about food. The work that I do specifically aside of policy work has been to organize our community through Northside Fresh Coalition and find opportunities for us to connect and create collaborative partnerships. We've created opportunities for retailers such as North Market, Worth Co-op, corner stores that are subject to the Staple Foods Ordinance in Minneapolis to come together and approach ways that can make produce specifically more affordable for residents of North Minneapolis and those that frequent their stores. And so opportunities for us to be able to offer discounts under our Fresh Bucks program, which is similar to Market Bucks, if you've ever heard of that. So instead of that for farmers markets, we have that that we're piloting within our stores. We're really looking at opportunities that we can create the connection both internally within partners that are already doing that food work and externally with those that may not be engaged in food work but are always engaged because we all eat, right? Or we all deserve to eat. So that's a little bit of a picture of our work. The coalition in itself took a trip to D.C. last year to advocate for urban agriculture and to really talk about what it means to grow food in urban spaces. And I think that there are a number of conversations that we've had across the state and the nation around how urban agriculture really fits into the picture in comparison to larger scale farm operations, mid-sized farm operations that are in more peri-urban and rural areas. But what we're trying to do is not necessarily compete with the larger developers of urban agriculture, but we're looking at ways that we can support our system in North Minneapolis and fill those gaps. So how do we get the person that has been wanting to farm access to land so that they can grow and sell to a farmer's market? Or maybe they're selling to a local co-op. And these have been really effective ways for us to get engaged and have a conversation around what it means to have a healthy food system in North Minneapolis. And as a result of a lot of the work that we have been doing at the Capitol in D.C., we were able to actually, for the first time in the Farm Bill's history, have a $25 million appropriation for an establishment of the Office of Urban Agriculture with a $9 million grant program establishment and as well as a 15-member committee across the nation. So this is a really amazing and exciting time for urban agriculture at all levels of governance. We really appreciate the $500,000 appropriation in the 2017 legislative session in Minnesota for the establishment of the Urban Agriculture Grant Program, and that's under AgriFunds. And it's been something that has been Really amazing to see a policy that community members have advocated for, and Karen Clark had worked with community members across the state to develop this legislation. And we have a number of partners within North Minneapolis and across the cities, such as Project Sweetie Pie, Youth Farm, and Appetite for Change, my organization, that have been funded through this program. But we also have partners that have been funded through the same program that are working in Robbinsdale and in Red Wing and in Virginia, Minnesota, just to clarify. And so this is something that we are really looking at from a statewide perspective on how we can look at small local agricultural systems as a tool to teach youth, as a way to revitalize our aging farming population that is to come in the next few decades, and really get youth excited about the idea of what it means to be a farmer and support their local community. So that's a majority of what I have right here, and I'll open it up for questions, but we will be coming hopefully to this committee during the session to ask for a refunding of the same urban agriculture grant program under AGRI.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ulysses, and certainly, for those that don't know Representative Karen Clark, she was a member of this committee in the past, but it was Representative Rod Hamilton who also, over the last 4 years, we spent a fair amount of time learning about urban agriculture and talking about the connection with food and youth and nutrition and everything that kind of goes along with it. Again, quite the spectrum of and connection. Absolutely. And so even though food is new to the title of this committee, we have certainly been talking about food over the number of years. So I appreciate your coming today. And
thank you.
And Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, you know, it was instrumental then. Representative Karen Clark, she invited us to come to Minneapolis and visit with different individuals around the community and to gain a better understanding of urban agriculture and realize, and I've said this multiple times, that it wasn't about simply growing a carrot. I mean, it was growing our youth and our communities and opportunities. It was fascinating, and it was an educational experience for me as well, right? And so to freshman legislators, feel free to invite us to your communities and vice versa, because it helped out tremendously. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and congratulations on an excellent program.
Thank you.
In other sessions or meetings, we've heard about some of the challenges you face in procuring land or space to operate your gardens, and the city sometimes would give you a lot to use, and then a couple of years later, they sold the lot for development. So how do you handle those challenges in getting land available for gardens and farming, we say, a long-term type operation. So how do you work with that?
Yeah,
Ms. Ulysses.
Yes, thank you for your question. A lot of the challenges that we have around land access, we are trying to approach from a local policy perspective. So while we've gone to the state legislature and have advocated for a farm bill policy, we've been working through the city of Minneapolis to find ways to increase land access. So the Minneapolis has a community garden lease program, and this is a great way for somebody to get started with growing food and testing the waters around farming. But like you said, they are susceptible to the opportunity for their land to be sold and developed on. And so a lot of the work that we've been doing the last 2 years has been working and advocating for the comprehensive planning process to include measures that will explore land access permanency. And the CPED department through the city of Minneapolis handles a lot of their land transactions, and we're trying to work to make sure that the process for procuring land and taking ownership of land is more clear and available to community members. Because community members, farmers, those that run nonprofits, do have the ability to purchase those lots. It's just more about how the process can be more transparent and working with CPED to make sure that that process is easily communicated to people. We've had tax forfeiture lots through Hennepin County that have been processed through the Park Board, and we have passed a lease policy through the Minneapolis Parks and Recreation Board in October of last year to be able to allow people to grow food in park board spaces. And that has been a really great way for us to start to get our foot in the water, just because Minneapolis Park Board is one of the largest landowners in the city of Minneapolis. But a lot of that just goes down to ownership and how do we at the smallest level prepare farmers to make sure that the work that they're doing will make financial sense. Because as you might know, if you've ever been a farmer, you're not going to get rich off of growing some vegetables. And to someone's point, how do we get those that are growing food to understand the beauty of value-added products and season extension and working to advocate for growing methods that would produce food during the winter time, and passing those policies so that people can render those structures and keep them up during the winter time without the city asking them to take them down. So a lot of it is looking to new research and ways of growing in season extension, exploring value-added products, and ways that those that are growing can aggregate their produce through a larger system like the Good Acre.
Thank you. Thanks again for coming today.
Thank
and
you.
Appreciate that you were able to provide that information to us. And I just want to make a note again that Ben Larson from Menu Youth Garden and Wilmer wasn't able to come because of the weather, but that program does combine youth farming and selling of produce. And it does also talk about culturally specific food, and that's important to them as well. So thank you so much for
thank
being
you.
Here.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Appreciate it. And then we will call down the last panel that we have. So if Bob and Joanna and Julie come forward, talking about local food markets again and food shelves and farm-to-food shelf. Second Harvest, all of those good things. So, and Marcus Schmidt is here.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, committee members. Marcus Schmidt, Director of Advocacy with Second Harvest Heartland. Really appreciate the committee's emphasis on food security and healthy access to food this week. Thank you, Madam Chair, for prioritizing that work. I'm joined here today by a couple of my colleagues who are going to work through some updates on some key programs. We really rely on the support of Minnesota's retailers and specifically Minnesota's agriculture community to do the work that we do at Second Harvest Heartland. We're the hub of Minnesota's emergency food system, the largest food bank in Minnesota, and last year, because of those partnerships and the support from this legislature, we were able to generate about 89 million meals to help reach the 1 in 11 Minnesotans that's experiencing hunger. So with that, I will turn it over to Bob, Julie, and Joanna to highlight some of the programs that we were asked to provide updates on. Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Schmidt. So as you come forward, just state your name and then provide your testimony. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bob Branham. I'm the Director of Produce Strategy at Second Harvest Heartland. I've been doing this work for about 6 years and have the luxury of describing some of the success we've had with the Farm to Food Shelf program that this body has supported during that period of time. And we, as you can see, we have slides, if I can turn them, and I did. All right, very good. So hunger relief, as we look at it today, is we've made improvements as our organization and the organizations you heard from earlier have been focused in on hunger relief. What we're doing these days is spending a lot more time thinking not just about hunger as in empty bellies, but nutritional hunger as well, and using the resources at our disposal to bring in the foods that we know that our neighbors with food insecurity need more than necessarily that they've been getting through the hunger relief system for the last several generations. So that's our work today. And as you can see, we are using this My Plate as a model of exactly what we're striving to with when we source and distribute the foods that our neighbors are looking for. So let me tell you a little bit about produce for those that don't know. In the state of Minnesota, there is for hunger relief, and this is really nationwide as well, an incredible surplus of fruits and vegetables that our farmers have and are willing to donate to us and have been donating for about the last 10 or 11 years in pretty significant quantities. But there are tens of millions of pounds left that we could get our hands on. if we continue to work with you and work in our own systems on improving our sourcing techniques, our infrastructure for distributing and managing that produce, and then having programs like Farm to Food Shelf to help us fund ways of making sure that our farmers have resources to help them make the donations to us. So with that, I'll tell you a little bit about Farm to Food Shelf as the program is laid out, and I know you can't read on the screens. I think you have it in front of you as well. So for the last 2 years, we've been had $1.1 million that we've used to reimburse our donors, the Minnesota growers, and some processors, really for the costs of what we call picking and pack out. So not for the product itself, that's donated to us. This is funds that we use to help them with whatever labor costs they might incur, but primarily a lot of it goes to packaging. It comes to us in bulk, 2,000-pound super sacks that those of you in the farm community are used to seeing, as well as case pack. And they make those donations to us at an incredibly low price that we work with the MDA and the farmers on at the beginning of the year to establish what price we will offer back as a subsidy to help them with their donation. To give you a reference point, that ranges between 4 cents a pound and maybe up to 25 cents a pound for case packed apples from Westcott. So there's a range, but it's an incredibly affordable one, and we pass that along, of course, to our agencies at an even lower cost, and then of course it goes to our clients for free. This program is built around the idea that we are getting donations from Minnesota growers only. The funds that are used are go to only Minnesota growers, and the food is dispersed to all Minnesota counties, all 87 counties, and the 400-plus agencies that serve our clients in need in across all of those counties. So we're delighted that Second Harvest Heartland was chosen to manage the program for all the food banks in the state. In the past year, this is about a 7.7 million pound program in donations that come to us from approximately 48 growers. As you can imagine, if you're knowledgeable about farming, it depends on the market, depends on weather, it depends on labor. There are a lot of forces that impact the amount of donations and from who and where we get them. It is primarily a program built around larger growers. I'd love to have a means to help the small farmers, as we talked about a little bit earlier with some of the other presenters. But this is for this program is built around bringing in full truckloads, 40,000-pound loads of potatoes from Peatland and apples from Westcott and corn from Gary Paul and those farms around the state that have the surplus, and they all do, and they all have more that they'd love to donate to us if we had the funds and we had the infrastructure to handle it. So we're delighted that we've been able to make sure that everyone who has access to, as an agency partner, has access to get distribution from a food bank, has more fresh fruits and vegetables. We've gotten as high as 25 different varieties from our growers in the state that we've been able to donate, and it's worked out incredibly well, to the point now where about 20% of all fruits and vegetables that are donated into the hunger relief system come from the Farm to Food Shelf program. So it's about a six-year-old program. It had some fits and starts at the beginning, but now it's going very well, and obviously we could not do it without your support. So thank you for all of that. It's part of our greater mission on nutrition that we'll continue to talk about throughout the testimony. But with that, if you have any questions specifically on produce, I'm here to answer.
All right. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the issues that we find in the food shelves that we service, and we do some food salvage, and I'll tell you a really quick story, but last year at Halloween, everyone decorates with squash and pumpkins and so on.
Yeah.
So we went out and salvaged the squash and distributed it out to the food shelves in our area, and we found out that most of it got thrown away. And we found out that that's true with a lot of produce, and that's because of two reasons. One, they don't know how to cook it,
mm-hmm.
or two, they don't have anything to cook it with. So we have developed a crockpot program where we're, with another organization, we're giving crockpots to people, and we've developed a cookbook that kind of teaches people how to use a crockpot to cook some of these things. Do you find that same thing, that a lot of produce goes in the garbage?
Well,
Mr. Branham.
Thank you for the question, Representative. The way I would answer that is we did a pretty comprehensive survey using some of our partners out in the private sector community around consumer insights with our clients. And we did pose the question to them about their ability and their desire and their preferences on produce. And honestly, what they came back to us, it was about 1,350 clients, came back and said is, we know how to cook. And yes, we have the utensils, so you don't have to challenge us on that. What we don't necessarily do is use for some of the produce that you're giving us. So, for example, Representative Vang was talking about culturally specific food. We had a produce drop at CAPI last summer of about 5,000 pounds that we brought over in 7 totes, and I sat and watched the community, the families come through and take all of the cabbage and all of the apples and all of the watermelon, but left behind a lot of the carrots and a lot of the sweet corn. And so part of the challenge for my group and our agency partners is to make sure, especially for my group, is to make sure that we get the right foods that the consumers, those folks that are consumers, our clients, will actually consume. You know, so it isn't that they don't know necessarily how to cook. It's their, sometimes it's just their preferences. If that makes sense.
It does.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for the presentation. I think we're moving on. Ms. Van Hove?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives of the committee. So my name is Julie Van Hove, and I work in sourcing at Second Harvest Heartland, and I also work on collaborative sourcing initiatives with all of the Feeding America food banks in the state. I'm here to talk about a little bit about the milk grant program that we have been able to generously receive from this committee in the past. We know that Minnesotans want access to healthier food at their local food shelves. And according to a 2017 study that was done of Minnesota food shelves, we also know that milk is the second item most requested by our clients. The current grant funding that we have allows us to meet about half of the demand from our food shelves and meal program partners in milk. In both fiscal year 18 and fiscal year 19, we received $550,000 in each of those 2 years, it's been given to the Feeding America food shelves that are serving the Minnesota counties to purchase fresh, fluid milk from our local processors and make available to agency food shelf and meal program partners in the state. The food banks that participate in this program are based in Minneapolis-St. Paul, in Rochester, Duluth, Crookston, Grand Rapids, and Fargo, North Dakota, who serves Clay County in Minnesota. According to the grant, the milk must be purchased from a Minnesota milk processor. So the processors that are used throughout these six food banks are Dean Foods, Land O'Lakes Dean Foods, as well as Dean Foods and Kemp's. The food banks are also asked to conduct a competitive bid so that they are assured that they're getting the best pricing for that milk. And then the grant funding is allocated to each of the food banks based on their TFAP allocation percent. And essentially that number represents the number of food insecure people that are being served within each of the food bank service areas. So I'm happy to report that in fiscal year 2018, we were able to purchase 674,000 half gallons of milk for our food shelf meal programs in the 87 Minnesota counties. And still, it represents about a half of the demand that we know that we are able to currently meet with our clients. Several of the food banks are only able to purchase milk for their food shelf programs and partner agencies when this grant is available throughout the year. So we know that there's more opportunity there. If I may, I'd like to take just a quick moment to deviate a little bit from milk. We know that milk is a good source of protein. We look to it to fulfill the dairy requirements in the plate that Bob showed earlier in the beginning of our discussion here. And from that same survey, we know that meat, poultry, fish are the most requested and in-demand items at our food shelves. However, unfortunately, lean meat protein is a scarcely donated commodity in the Feeding America network, and also costly for our food shelves to purchase. So along with the great work that is being done with produce and milk in partnership with the state and all of our other partners in the state, and in helping to balance the nutrition for those we serve, the state food banks are also trying to double the amount of lean meat protein that we distribute to food shelf programs and meal programs in the next 5 years. So that's next on horizon as we've been able to build great programs with produce and with milk. Protein is equally on our radar and just as important, if not more important, to the clients that we serve. So thank you for the opportunity to share, and also thank you for the support that you've given us in this program.
Thank you, Ms. Hope. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Those are music to my ears to hear the demand on milk and how good it is and how demanded it is, and much in demand. And you mentioned that the grants we've given you in the past have covered about half of the need out there for the milk program. So with your help, Madam Chair, we'd certainly like to offer some legislation that's being drafted now to increase that grant for milk to be used in the food shelves, and to just want to encourage the use of it. And also, we need to increase demand for milk produced by our Minnesota dairy farmers. So thank you for the work in that area. And we'd like to, if budgets would permit, probably increase that that grant for milk. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative Anderson, Ms. Van Hove.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so now we are going to go on to Ms. Lott.
Thank you. Thank you, committee members, and Madam Chair, for the opportunity for all of us to speak. My name is Joanna Lund. I'm a child hunger specialist at Second Harvest Heartland. I specialize in after-school meals program and the summer food service program and summer meals, and I'm here to speak with you a little bit today about the federal program, Summer Food Service Program, or SFSP. As some of you may know, food insecurity among children is a little bit elevated from adults in Minnesota. About 1 in 8 children across the state experience food insecurity, and this can happen for myriad reasons, from low-paying jobs or job loss, disability, other medical expenses, emergencies that come up that throw families and their expenses into turmoil. A separate stat that Mr. Harms referenced that we see in Minnesota to illuminate the prevalence of food insecurity is that about 320,000 students in Minnesota are part of the free and reduced meals program, and that is an income-based program. So under this program, students receive free meals at their school lunch, and if other programs like breakfast and snacks are served, they receive those as well. For many students in Minnesota, the meals that they receive in schools are their primary source of nutrition that they receive throughout the day. So during school holidays or weekends or summer break, they lose access to those nutritious meals. And with no other source of income or resources that readily supports families during this time, tight family budgets are stretched even thinner, and everyone suffers. So here we bring in the Summer Food Service Program. It is meant to be, again, this is a federal program. It's not a program that's part of Second Harvest Heartland. It's meant to serve as an extension of the National School Lunch Program to fill that gap during the summer. And under this program, community and school sponsors can create meal sites in area-eligible locations that are determined by income. And once a meal site is established, any youth 18 or under can come receive a free meal at this meal site if they come during times of service. There's no registration required, no ID required. The meals are free for the youth, and they're reimbursed by the USDA, so they can be no cost for the organization to serve. So it sounds like a really great program. It offers a lot of benefits. It provides kids with free, wholesome meals. It provides a safe place for kids to go to be with other kids in support of adults during the summer, and often the meal sites are partnered with enrichment activities. So it offers an additional kind of supportive environment for those kids. It helps parents stretch their food dollars when they don't have any additional income, like I said before. And it provides food service workers with summer employment, where often they'd be off without pay for 3 months. The negative part about SFSP is that it is severely underutilized. Our partners at the National Organization Share Our Strength estimate that only about 17.3% of students enrolled in free and reduced meals are eating summer meals in Minnesota. So that's what this slide is representing. Again, this program is available to any youth regardless of income, but it can be assumed that there's likely to be a higher need for this program among students who utilize the free and reduced meals program. So like I said, we have about 320,000 students, and if you look at that 17% participation, that means that 55,000 of our free and reduced meal students are getting meals in the summer, but that means that about 265,000 students are not receiving meals, are not participating in the program, and that's a pretty sizable gap. So if the lack of access to nutritious food has really long-lasting and detrimental effects on our youth into adulthood, and this means that we're not doing the best that we can to raise a healthy and effective society and workforce. So if we can go to the next slide, please. This shows some of the effects that lack of access to healthy food leaves with our youth. In the first part of the slide on the left side there, you can see that without access to nutritious summer meals, children from low-income families are more likely to experience weight gain and obesity as they resort to less healthy but easily accessible food options. And this makes them more susceptible to chronic diseases and subsequently more frequent hospitalizations. It also has an effect on mental health. For example, children who experience food insecurity are nearly five times as likely to suffer from depression and suicide, which is a pretty astounding stat, I think. In the middle column there, impact on learning. Proper nutrition supports continued brain development and the cognitive functioning necessary to maintain academic achievements made during the school year. So that's talking about the summer slide that we see and start to see disparities across different socioeconomic sectors. As I mentioned before, also, summer meals are often co-located with opportunities for learning and socialization, which means that there's an additional support for school readiness. We see this especially in immigrant populations. They have a really great opportunity to practice English in the summer where they otherwise wouldn't have that exposure for 3 months. And then the impact on family. The struggle to replace school meals creates economic hardship for already struggling families, and you can see there that there's a trade-off when they have to make decisions between purchasing food and paying utilities or housing, rent, things like that. So summer is often thought as a fun time during the year, but for many students, it's a time when they won't have access to food and additional hardship on families. So some of the reasons SFSP is not more utilized, we've been talking a lot about cultural sensitivity in food or just desirability of the food and programming. A lot of bureaucratic hurdles. There's a lot of paperwork. It's heavy on regulation. Weather, a lot of them are hosted in the summer for kids to be able to get there. Transportation is an issue. Their children, the parents are working. In a greater Minnesota, we don't see the transportation infrastructure like we have here. Huge stigma that, like, they don't want to be the poor kids that are utilizing these programs, and often it comes across as that, even though it's available to all youth. Lastly, I think biggest is lack of awareness. People just don't know about this program. So what Second Harvest is doing, statewide, this program served over 3.2 million meals last summer. Second Harvest supported our sponsors in serving over 1.1 million meals across our service area at over 385 meal sites. We have strong partnerships here in the metro and throughout our service area in the suburbs and in greater Minnesota, and we're working to really increase our partnerships in greater Minnesota and kind of especially first-ring suburbs to increase the quality of programming through technical expertise, financial resources, program guidance, and in certain cases, intern support to help get those programs off the ground where they face even more elevated barriers than we see here in the metro. So I'll stop there if there's time for questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Wozlewek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was actually going to ask about what the factors are and why that program is underutilized, so she answered my question. Thanks.
If I can say something really quickly, thank you. That was like really, really simplified and distilled, obviously, that each of those have a lot of complexities and nuances, too, that differ by sponsor and by population and by area, too. So that's a really, on paper it sounds really great, but in practice it's a very challenging program.
Thank you, Ms. Lund. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and first a shout-out to you for establishing the Farm to Food Shelf program. I believe you're the chief author in that, and mm-hmm. it's fun to see how that's mm-hmm. grown into what it is and the success around that. My question on the meat protein, I've had some conversations with other entities, and they're talking about you talked about a little bit about how difficult it is to whether it's the lifespan of the product or the just being able to deliver it or whatever. Is anybody donating like certificates that can be used, picked up at the food shelf and then be used at maybe a local grocery or anything like that? I guess that's my question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is not a program that I've heard of in the past, but I think that's a really awesome idea. I will tell you one of the biggest barriers to donated protein, because we bring it into our facility and it's distributed to food shelves and clients in the frozen state, so that does extend the shelf life. But the biggest barrier is that in that industry, when there is an overrun of product or there is a product that's produced but is a little bit off spec for what they could sell to retailers, that's normally where product comes to us in the donated form. In the protein market, there's a secondary market that exists where they can sell that product still for a fairly high value. And so there just isn't that much left after that happens for us to find donated. But I think that's an interesting approach and something to consider, because we definitely need to get creative about how we help here.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know, like, the Minnesota pork producers, we can call up David Preisler or others, and we can purchase gift certificates from them that can be used anywhere across Minnesota, going to a local grocer. And I know there's individuals within the industry that would like to be creative, too, on how to support the need. And so it's just one other possible idea that we could do to help out.
Awesome. Thank you. We'll take a look at that.
Great. Thank you. Thank you again to the panelists for today to come and to share information. And I know weather was a factor for lots of people, so we appreciate that you were able to come and present. Just as a reminder for the committee, next week we will be talking with the Minnesota Department of Ag on their budget. So we'll have a couple of meetings on that. And on Friday next week, if you're wanting to participate, we're going to go to the Department of Ag for a tour. And I know that there are some people that have done that numerous times, so you don't necessarily need to participate in that. But we welcome you, and we encourage new people to be able to know where the Department of Ag is and to see their facilities. So, again, today, thank you. This was a great full spectrum of information. We very much appreciate the fact that everybody was able to be here. So with that, meeting adjourned. We did not do the minutes. Okay. We'll do them next.